Disc 4.
The Companion. Now, Dr. Lloyd, says Miss Heller, don't you know any creepy stories? She smiled at him, the smile that nightly bewitched the theatre-going public. Jane Heller was sometimes called the most beautiful woman in England, and jealous members of her own profession were in the habit of saying to each other, "Of course Jane's not an artist. She can't act, if you know what I mean. It's those eyes." And those eyes were at this minute fixed appealingly on the grizzled, elderly bachelor doctor, who for the last 5 years had ministered to the ailments of the village of St. Mary Mead. With an unconscious gesture, the doctor pulled down his waistcoat, inclined of late to be uncomfortably tight, and racked his brains hastily so as not to disappoint the lovely creature who addressed him so confidently. "I feel," said Jane dreamily, "that I would like to wallow in crime this evening." "Splendid," said Colonel Bantry, her host. "Splendid, splendid." And he laughed a loud, hearty, military laugh. "Eh, Dolly?" His wife, hastily recalled to the exigencies of social life, she had been planning her spring boarder, agreed enthusiastically. "Of course, it's splendid," she said heartily, but vaguely. "I always thought so." "Did you, my dear?" said old Miss Marple, and her eyes twinkled a little. "We don't get much in the creepy line, and still less in the criminal line, in St. Mary Mead, you know, Miss Heller," said Dr. Lloyd. "You surprise me," said Sir Henry Clithering. The ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard turned to Miss Marple. "I always understood from our friend here that St. Mary Mead is a positive hotbed of crime and vice." "Oh, Sir Henry," protested Miss Marple, a spot of colour coming into her cheeks, "I'm sure I never said anything of the kind. The only thing I ever said was that human nature is much the same in a village as anywhere else, only one has opportunities and leisure for seeing it at closer quarters." "But you haven't always lived here," said Jane Heller, still addressing the doctor. "You've been in all sorts of queer places all over the world, places where things happen." "That is so, of course," said Dr. Lloyd, still thinking desperately. "Yes, of course. Yes, now I have it." He sank back with a sigh of relief. "It's some years ago now, I'd almost forgotten, but the facts were really very strange indeed. And the final coincidence which put the clue into my hand was strange also." Miss Heller drew her chair a little nearer to him, applied some lipstick, and waited expectantly. The others also turned interested faces towards him. "I don't know whether any of you know the Canary Islands," began the doctor. "Oh, they must be wonderful," said Jane Heller. "They're in the South Seas, aren't they? Or is it in the Mediterranean?" "I've called in there on my way to South Africa," said the colonel. "The peak of Tenerife is a fine sight with the setting sun on it." "The incident I'm describing happened in the island of Gran Canaria, not Tenerife. It's a good many years ago now. I had had a breakdown in health and was forced to give up my practice in England to go abroad. I practiced in Las Palmas, which is the principal town of Gran Canaria. In many ways, I enjoyed the life out there very much. The climate was mild and sunny, there was excellent surf bathing, and I am an enthusiastic bather, and the sea life of the port attracted me. Ships from all over the world put in at Las Palmas. I used to walk along the mole every morning, far more interested than any member of the fair sex could be in a street of hat shops. As I say, ships from all over the world put in at Las Palmas. Sometimes they stayed a few hours, sometimes a day or two. In the principal hotel there, the Metropole, you'll see people of all races and nationalities, birds of passage. Even the people going to Tenerife usually come here and stay a few days before crossing to the other island. My story begins there, in the Metropole Hotel, one Thursday evening in January. There was a dance going on, and I and my friend had been sitting at a small table watching the scene. There were a fair sprinkling of English and other nationalities, but the majority of the dancers were Spanish. And when the orchestra struck up a tango, only half a dozen couples of the latter nationality took the floor. They all danced well, and we looked on and admired. One woman in particular excited our lively admiration. Tall, beautiful, and sinuous, she moved with the grace of a half-tamed leopardess. There was something dangerous about her. I said as much to my friend, and he agreed. Women like that, he said, are bound to have a history. Life will not pass them by. Beauty is perhaps a dangerous possession, I said. Not only beauty, he insisted, there's something else. Now look at that again. Things are bound to happen to that woman, or because of her. As I said, life will not pass her by. Strange and exciting events will surround her. You've only got to look at her to know it. He paused, and then added with a smile, just as you've only got to look at those two women over there, and to know nothing out of the way could ever happen to either of them. They're made for a safe and uneventful existence. I followed his eyes. The two women he referred to were travellers who had just arrived. A Holland Lloyd boat had put into port that evening, and the passengers were just beginning to arrive. As I looked at them, I saw at once what my friend meant. They were two English ladies, the thoroughly nice travelling English that you do find abroad. Their ages, I should say, were round about 40. One was fair and a little, just a little, too plump. The other was dark and a little, again, just a little, inclined to scragginess. They were what is called well-preserved, quietly and inconspicuously dressed in well-cut tweeds, and innocent of any kind of make-up. They had that air of quiet assurance which is the birthright of well-bred Englishwomen. There was nothing remarkable about either of them. They were like thousands of their sisters. They would doubtless see what they wished to see, assisted by Baedeker, and be blind to everything else. They would use the English library and attend the English church in any place they happened to be, and it was quite likely that one or both of them sketched a little. And as my friend said, nothing exciting or remarkable would ever happen to either of them, though they might quite likely travel half over the world. I looked from them back to our sinuous Spanish woman, with her half-closed smouldering eyes, and I smiled. "Poor thing," said Jane Hellier with a sigh, "but I do think it's so silly of people not to make the most of themselves. That woman in Bond Street, Valentine, is really wonderful. Audrey Denman goes to her. Have you seen her in The Downward Step? As a schoolgirl in the first act, she's really marvellous. And yet Audrey is 50 if she's a day, and as a matter of fact, I happen to know she's really nearer 60. "'Go on,' said Mrs. Bantry to Dr. Lloyd. "'I love stories about sinuous Spanish dancers. "'It makes me forget how old and fat I am.' "'I'm sorry,' said Dr. Lloyd apologetically, "'but you see, as a matter of fact, this story isn't about the Spanish woman.' "'Isn't. "'No. As it happens, my friend and I were wrong. "'Nothing in the least exciting happened to the Spanish beauty.' She married a clerk in a shipping office, and by the time I left the island she had 5 children and was getting very fat. "'Just like that girl of Israel Peters,' commented Miss Marple, "'the one who went on the stage and had such good legs that they made her principal boy in the pantomime. "'Everyone said she'd come to no good, but she married a commercial traveller and settled down splendidly.' "'The village parallel,' murmured Sir Henry softly. "'No,' went on the doctor, "'my story is about the two English ladies.' "'Something happened to them,' breathed Miss Hellier. "'Something happened to them, and the very next day, too.' "'Yes,' said Mrs. Bantry encouragingly. "'Just for curiosity, as I went out that evening, "'I glanced at the hotel register. "'I found the names easily enough. "'Miss Mary Barton and Miss Amy Durrant of Little Paddocks, Courton Weir, Bucks.' I little thought then how soon I was to encounter the owner of those names again, and under what tragic circumstances. The following day I had arranged to go for a picnic with some friends. We were to motor across the island, taking our lunch to a place called, as far as I remember, it's so long ago, Las Nieves, a well-sheltered bay where we could bathe if we felt inclined. This programme we duly carried out, except that we were somewhat late in starting, so that we stopped on the way and picnicked, going on to Las Nieves afterwards for a bathe before tea. As we approached the beach, we were at once aware of a tremendous commotion. The whole population of the small village seemed to be gathered on the shore. As soon as they saw us, they rushed towards the car and began explaining excitedly. My Spanish not being very good, it took me a few minutes to understand, but at last I got it. Two of the mad English ladies had gone in to bathe, and one had swum out too far and got into difficulties. The other had gone after her and had tried to bring her in, but her strength in turn had failed, and she too would have been drowned had not a man rowed out in a boat and brought in rescuer and rescued, the latter beyond help. As soon as I got the hang of things, I pushed the crowd aside and hurried down to the beach. I did not at first recognize the two women, the plump figure in the black stockinette costume and the tight green rubber bathing cap awoke no chord of recognition as she looked up anxiously. She was kneeling beside the body of her friend, making somewhat amateurish attempts at artificial respiration. When I told her that I was a doctor, she gave a sigh of relief, and I ordered her off at once to one of the cottages for a rub-down and dry clothing. One of the ladies in my party went with her. I myself worked unavailingly on the body of the drowned woman in vain. Life was only too clearly extinct, and in the end I had reluctantly to give in. I rejoined the others in a small fisherman's cottage, and there I had to break the sad news. The survivor was attired now in her own clothes, and I immediately recognized her as one of the two arrivals of the night before. She received the sad news fairly calmly, and it was evidently the horror of the whole thing that struck her more than any great personal feeling. "Poor Amy," she said. "Poor, poor Amy. She'd been looking forward to the bathing here so much, and she was a good swimmer, too. I can't understand it. What do you think it can have been, Doctor?"
"Possibly cramp. Will you tell me exactly what happened?"
"We had both been swimming about for some time. 20 minutes, I should say. Then I thought I would go in, but Amy said she was going to swim out once more. She did so, and suddenly I heard her call and realized that she was crying for help. I swam out as fast as I could. She was still afloat when I got to her, but she clutched me wildly, and we both went under. If it hadn't been for that man coming out with his boat, I should have been drowned too."
"That has happened fairly often," I said. "To save anyone from drowning is not an easy affair."
"Seems so awful," continued Miss Barton. "We only arrived yesterday. We were so delighting in the sunshine and our little holiday, and now this terrible tragedy occurs."
I asked her then for particulars about the dead woman, explaining that I would do everything I could for her, but that the Spanish authorities would require full information. This she gave me readily enough. The dead woman, Miss Amy Durrant, was her companion, and had come to her about 5 months previously. They had got on very well together, but Miss Durrant had spoken very little about her people. She had been left an orphan at an early age, and had been brought up by an uncle, and had earned her own living since she was 21. "And so that was that," went on the doctor. He paused and said again, but this time with a certain finality in his voice, "And so, that was that."
"I don't understand," said Jane Hellyer. "Is that all? I mean, it's very tragic, and I suppose, but it isn't what I call creepy."
"I think there's more to follow," said Sir Henry. "Yes," said Dr. Lloyd, "there's more to follow. You see, right at the time, there was one queer thing. Of course, I asked questions of the fishermen, etc., as to what they'd seen. They were eyewitnesses. And one woman had rather a funny story. I didn't pay any attention to it at the time, but it came back to me afterwards. She insisted, you see, that Miss Durrant wasn't in difficulties when she called out. The other swam out to her, and according to this woman, deliberately held Miss Durrant's head under water. I didn't, as I say, pay much attention. It was such a fantastic story, and these things look so differently from the shore. Miss Barton might have tried to make her friend lose consciousness, realizing that the latter's panic-stricken clutching would drown them both. You see, according to the Spanish woman's story, it looked as though, well, as though Miss Barton was deliberately trying to drown her companion. As I say, I paid very little attention to this story at the time. It came back to me later. Our great difficulty was to find out anything about this woman, Amy Durrant. She didn't seem to have any relations. Miss Barton and I went through her things together. We
found one address and wrote there, but it proved to be simply a room that she had taken in which to keep some of her things. The landlady knew nothing, had only seen her when she took the room. Miss Durrant had remarked at the time that she always liked to have one place she could call her own, to which she could return at any moment. There were one or two nice pieces of old furniture, and some bound numbers of Academy pictures, and a trunk full of pieces of material bought at sales, but no personal belongings. She had mentioned to the landlady that her father and mother had died in India when she was a child, and that she had been brought up by an uncle who was a clergyman. But she did not say if he was her father's or her mother's brother. So the name was no guide. It wasn't exactly mysterious. It was just unsatisfactory. There must be many lonely women, proud and reticent, in just that position. There were a couple of old photographs amongst her belongings in Las Palmas, rather old and faded, and they had been cut to fit the frames they were in, so that there was no photographer's name on them. And there was an old daguerreotype which might have been her mother, or more probably her grandmother. Miss Barton had had two references with her. One she had forgotten, the other name she recollected after an effort. It proved to be that of a lady who was now abroad, having gone to Australia. She was written to. Her answer, of course, was a long time in coming, and I may say that when it did arrive, there was no particular help to be gained from it. She said Miss Durrant had been with her as companion, and had been most efficient, and that she was a very charming woman, but that she knew nothing of her private affairs or relations. So there it was. As I say, nothing unusual, really. It was just the two things together that aroused my uneasiness. This Amy Durrant, of whom no one knew anything, and the Spanish woman's queer story. Yes, and I'll add a third thing. When I was first bending over the body, and Miss Barton was walking away towards the huts, she looked back. Looked back with an expression on her face that I can only describe as one of poignant anxiety, the kind of anguished uncertainty that imprinted itself on my brain. It didn't strike me as anything unusual at the time. I put it down to her terrible distress over her friend. But you see, later, I realized that they weren't on those terms. There was no devoted attachment between them, no terrible grief. Miss Barton was fond of Amy Durrant and was shocked by her death. But that was all. But then, why that terrible, poignant anxiety? That was the question that kept coming back to me. I had not been mistaken in that look. And almost against my will, an answer began to shape itself in my mind. Supposing the Spanish woman's story were true, supposing that Mary Barton willfully and in cold blood tried to drown Amy Durrant. She succeeds in holding her under water while pretending to be saving her. She's rescued by a boat. They're on a lonely beach far from anywhere. And then I appear, the last thing she expects, a doctor, and an English doctor. She knows well enough that people who have been underwater far longer than Amy Durrant have been revived by artificial respiration. But she has to play her part, to go off leaving me alone with her victim. And as she turns for one last look, a terrible poignant anxiety shows in her face. Will Amy Durrant come back to life and tell what she knows? "Oh," said Jane Hillier, "I'm thrilled now." Viewed in that aspect, the whole business seemed more sinister, and the personality of Amy Durrant became more mysterious. Who was Amy Durrant? Why should she, an insignificant paid companion, be murdered by her employer? What story lay behind that fatal bathing expedition? She had entered Mary Barton's employment only a few months before. Mary Barton had brought her abroad, and the very day after they landed, the tragedy had occurred. And they were both nice, commonplace, refined Englishwomen. The whole thing was fantastic, and I told myself so. I had been letting my imagination run away with me. "You didn't do anything then?" asked Miss Hellyer. "My dear young lady, what could I do? There was no evidence. The majority of the eyewitnesses told the same story as Miss Barton. I had built up my own suspicions out of a fleeting expression which I might quite possibly have imagined. The only thing I could do and did do was to see that the widest inquiries were made for the relations of Amy Durrant. The next time I was in England, I even went and saw the landlady of her room, with the results I've told you." "But you felt there was something wrong," said Miss Marple. Dr. Lloyd nodded. "Half the time I was ashamed of myself for thinking so. Who was I to go suspecting this nice, pleasant-mannered English lady of a foul and cold-blooded crime? I did my best to be as cordial as possible to her during the short time she stayed on the island. I helped her with the Spanish authorities. I did everything I could do as an Englishman to help a compatriot in a foreign country. And yet I'm convinced that she knew I suspected and disliked her." "How long did she stay out there?" asked Miss Marple. "I think it was about a fortnight. Miss Durrant was buried there, and it must have been about 10 days later when she took a boat back to England. The shock had upset her so much that she felt she couldn't spend the winter there as she had planned. That's what she said." "Did it seem to have upset her?" asked Miss Marple. The doctor hesitated. "Well, I don't know that it affected her appearance at all," he said cautiously. "She didn't, for instance, grow fatter?" asked Miss Marple. "Do you know? It's a curious thing you're saying that. Now I come to think back, I believe you're right. Yes, she did seem, if anything, to be putting on weight." "How horrible," said Jane Hellyer with a shudder. It's like fattening on your victim's blood. And yet, in another way, I may be doing her an injustice," went on Dr. Lloyd. "She certainly said something before she left which pointed in an entirely different direction. There may be, I think there are, consciences which work very slowly, which take some time to awake the enormity of the deed committed. It was the evening before her departure from the Canaries. She had asked me to go and see her, and had thanked me very warmly for all that I had done to help her. I, of course, made light of the matter, said I had only done what was natural under the circumstances, and so on. There was a pause after that, and then she suddenly asked me a question. "Do you think," she asked, "that one is ever justified in taking the law into one's own hands?" I replied that that was rather a difficult question, but on the whole I thought not. The law was the law, and we had to abide by it. Even when it is powerless? I don't quite understand. It's difficult to explain, but one might do something that is considered definitely wrong, that is considered a crime even, for a very good and sufficient reason. I replied dryly that possibly several criminals had thought that in their time, and she shrank back. "Oh, but that's horrible," she murmured. And then, with a change of tone, she asked me to give her something to make her sleep. She had not been able to sleep properly since, she hesitated, since that terrible shock. "You're sure it is that? There's nothing worrying you, nothing on your mind?" "On my mind? What should be on my mind?" She spoke fiercely and suspiciously. "Worry is a cause of sleeplessness sometimes," I said lightly. She seemed to brood for a moment. "Do you mean worrying over the future, or worrying over the past, which can't be altered?" "Either. Only it wouldn't be any good worrying over the past. You couldn't bring back... Oh, what's the use? One mustn't think. One must not think." I prescribed her a mild sleeping draught and made my adieu. As I went away, I wondered not a little over the words she had spoken. You couldn't bring back what or who. I think that last interview prepared me in a way for what was to come. I didn't expect it, of course, but when it happened, I wasn't surprised. Because, you see, Mary Barton struck me all along as a conscientious woman. Not a weak sinner,
but a woman with convictions who would act up to them and who would not relent as long as she still believed in them. I fancied that in that last conversation we had, she was beginning to doubt her own convictions. I know her words suggested to me that she was feeling the first faint beginnings of that terrible soul-searcher, remorse. The thing happened in Cornwall, in a small watering place, rather deserted at that season of the year. Must have been, let me see, late March. I read about it in the papers. A lady had been staying at a small hotel there, a Miss Barton. She'd been very odd and peculiar in her manner. That had been noticed by all. At night she would walk up and down her room, muttering to herself and not allowing the people on either side of her to sleep. She called on the vicar one day and told him that she had a communication of the gravest importance to make to him. She had, she said, committed a crime. Then, instead of proceeding, she had stood up abruptly and said she would call another day. The vicar put her down as being slightly unbalanced, and did not take her self-accusation seriously. The very next morning she was found to be missing from her room. A note was left addressed to the coroner. It ran as follows. "I tried to speak to the vicar yesterday to confess all, but was not allowed. She would not let me. I can make amends only one way, a life for a life, and my life must go the same way as hers did. I, too, must drown in the deep sea." I believed I was justified. I see now that that was not so. If I desire Amy's forgiveness, I must go to her. Let no one be blamed for my death. Mary Barton. Her clothes were found lying on the beach in a secluded cove nearby, and it seemed clear that she had undressed there and swum resolutely out to sea, where the current was known to be dangerous, sweeping one down the coast. The body was not discovered. But after a time leave was given to presume death. She was a rich woman, her estate being proved at £100,000. Since she died intestate, it all went to her next of kin, a family of cousins in Australia. The papers made discreet references to the tragedy in the Canary Islands, putting forward the theory that the death of Miss Durrant had unhinged her friend's brain. At the inquest, the usual verdict of suicide whilst temporarily insane was returned. And so the curtain falls on the tragedy of Amy Durrant and Mary Barton. There was a long pause, and then Jane Hillier gave a great gasp. "Oh, but you mustn't stop there. Just in the most interesting part. Go on." "But you see, Miss Hillier, this isn't a serial story. This is real life, and real life stops just where it chooses." "But I don't want it to," said Jane. "I want to know." "This is where we use our brains, Miss Hillier," explained Sir Henry. "Why did Mary Barton kill her companion? That's the problem Dr. Lloyd has set us." "Oh, well," said Miss Hillier, "she might have killed her for lots of reasons. I mean, I don't know, she might have got on her nerves, or else she got jealous, although Dr. Lloyd doesn't mention any men, but still on the boat out. Well, you know what everyone says about boats and sea voyages." Miss Hillier paused, slightly out of breath, and it was borne in upon her audience that the outside of Jane's charming head was distinctly superior to the inside. "I would like to have a lot of guesses," said Mrs. Bantry, "and I suppose I must confine myself to one. Well, I think that Miss Barton's father made all his money out of ruining Amy Durrant's father, so Amy determined to have her revenge. Oh, no, it's the wrong way round. How tiresome. Why does the rich employer kill the humble companion? I've got it. Miss Barton had a young brother who shot himself for love of Amy Durrant. Miss Barton waits her time. Amy comes down in the world. Miss B engages her as a companion and takes her to the Canaries and accomplishes her revenge. Now, how's that?" "Excellent," said Sir Henry, "only we don't know that Miss Barton ever had a young brother."
"'We deduce that,' said Mrs. Bantry, "'that she had a young brother. "'There's no motive, so she must have had a young brother. "'Do you see, Watson?'
"'Well, that's all very fine, Dolly,' said her husband, "'but it's only a guess.'
"'Of course it is,' said Mrs. Bantry. "'That's all we can do, guests. "'We haven't got any clues. "'Go on, dear, have a guess yourself.'
"'Upon my word, I don't know what to say, "'but I think there's something in Miss Hillier's suggestion "'that they fell out about a man. "'Now, look here, Dolly, it was probably some high church parson. "'They both embroidered him a cope or something, "'and he wore the Dunant woman's first. "'Depend upon it, it was something like that. "'Look how she went off to a parson at the end.' These women all lose their heads over good-looking clergymen. You hear of it over and over again.
I think I must try and make my explanation a little more subtle, said Sir Henry, though I admit it's only a guess. I suggest that Miss Barton was always mentally unhinged. There are more cases like that than you would imagine. Her mania grew stronger, and she began to believe it her duty to rid the world of certain persons, possibly what is termed unfortunate females. Nothing much is known about Miss Durrant's past, so very possibly she had a past. An unfortunate one. Miss Barton learns of this and decides on extermination. Later, the righteousness of her act begins to trouble her, and she's overcome by remorse. Her end shows her to be completely unhinged. Now, do say you agree with me, Miss Marple.
"'I'm afraid I don't, Sir Henry,' said Miss Marple, smiling apologetically. "'I think her end shows her to have been a very clever and resourceful woman.' Jane Hillier interrupted with a little scream.
"'Oh, I've been so stupid. May I guess again? Of course it must have been that. Blackmail. The companion woman was blackmailing her. Only I don't see why Miss Marple said it was clever of her to kill herself. I can't see that at all.'
"'Ah,' said Sir Henry, "'you see, Miss Marple knew a case just like it in St. Mary Mead.'
"'You always laugh at me, Sir Henry,' said Miss Marple reproachfully. "'I must confess it does remind me just a little of old Mrs. Trout. "'She drew the old age pension, you know, for three old women who were dead in different parishes.'
"'Sounds like a most complicated and resourceful crime,' said Sir Henry, "'but it doesn't seem to throw much light upon our present problem.'
"'Of course not,' said Miss Marple. "'It wouldn't, to you. "'But some of the families were very poor, "'and the old age pension was a great boon to the children. "'I know it's difficult for anyone outside to understand, "'but what I really meant was that the whole thing hinged upon "'one old woman being so like any other old woman.'
"'Eh?' said Sir Henry, mystified.
"'Oh, I always explain things so badly. "'What I mean is that when Dr. Lloyd described the two ladies first, "'he didn't know which was which. "'And I don't suppose anyone else in the hotel did. "'They would have, of course, after a day or so, "'but the very next day one of the two was drowned. "'And if the one who was left said she was Miss Barton, "'I don't suppose it would ever occur to anyone else that she might be.'
"'You think... "'Oh, I see,' said Sir Henry slowly.
"'It's the only natural way of thinking of it. "'Dear Mrs. Bantry began that way just now. "'Why should the rich employer kill the humble companion? "'So much more likely to be the other way about. "'I mean, that's the way things happen.'
"'Is it?' said Sir Henry. "'You shock me.'
"'But of course,' went on Miss Marple, "'she would have had to wear Miss Barton's clothes, "'and they would probably be a little tight on her, "'so that her general appearance would look as though she had got a little fatter. "'That's why I asked that question. "'A gentleman would be sure to think it was the lady who had got fatter, "'and not the clothes that got smaller, "'though that isn't quite the right way of putting it. "'But if Amy Durrant kills Miss Barton, "'what did she gain by it?' asked Mrs. Bantry. "'She couldn't keep up the deception for ever.' "'She only kept it up for another month or so,' pointed out Miss Marple, "'and during that time I expect she travelled, "'keeping away from anyone who might know her. "'That's what I meant by saying that one lady of a certain age "'looks so like another. "'I don't suppose the different photograph on her passport was ever noticed. "'You know what passports are. "'And then in March she went down to this Cornish place and began to act queerly and draw attention to herself so that when people found her clothes on the beach and read her last letter, they shouldn't think of the common-sense conclusion. "Which was?" asked Sir Henry. "No body," said Miss Marple firmly. "That's the thing that would stare you in the face if there weren't such a lot of red herrings to draw you off the trail, including the suggestion of foul play and remorse. No body." That was the real significant fact.
"Do you mean," said Mrs. Bantry, "do you mean that there wasn't any remorse, that there wasn't, that she didn't drown herself?"
"Not she," said Miss Marple. "It's just Mrs. Trout over again. Mrs. Trout was very good at red herrings, but she met her match in me, and I can see through your remorse-driven Miss Barton. Drown herself? Went off to Australia, if I'm any good at guessing."
"You are, Miss Marple," said Dr. Lloyd. "Undoubtedly you are. Now it again took me quite by surprise. Why, you could have knocked me down with a feather that day in Melbourne."
"Was that what you spoke of as a final coincidence?" Dr. Lloyd nodded.
"Yes, rather rough luck on Miss Barton, or Miss Amy Durrant, whatever you like to call her. I became a ship's doctor for a while, and landing in Melbourne, the first person I saw as I walked down the street was the lady I thought had been drowned in Cornwall. She saw the game was up as far as I was concerned, and she did the bold thing. Took me into her confidence. Curious woman, completely lacking, I suppose, in some moral sense. She was the eldest of a family of nine, all wretchedly poor. They had applied once for help to their rich cousin in England and been repulsed. Miss Barton having quarrelled with their father. Money was wanted desperately, for the three youngest children were delicate and wanted expensive medical treatment. Amy Barton, then and there, seems to have decided on her plan of cold-blooded murder. She set out for England, working her passage over as a children's nurse. She obtained the situation of companion to Miss Barton, calling herself Amy Durrant. She engaged a room and put some furniture in it so as to create more of a personality for herself. The drowning plan was a sudden inspiration. She'd been waiting for some opportunity to present itself. Then she staged the final scene of the drama and returned to Australia. And in due time she and her brothers and sisters inherited Miss Barton's money as next of kin. "A very bold and perfect crime," said Sir Henry. "Almost the perfect crime. If it had been Miss Barton who had died in the Canaries, suspicion might have attached to Amy Durrant and her connection with the Barton family might have been discovered. But the change of identity and the double crime, as you may call it, effectually did away with that. Yes, almost the perfect crime."
"What happened to her?" asked Mrs. Bantry. "What did you do in the matter, Dr. Lloyd?"
"I was in a very curious position, Mrs. Bantry. Of evidence, as the law understands it, I still had very little. Also, there were certain signs, plain to me as a medical man, that though strong and vigorous in appearance, the lady was not long for this world. I went home with her and saw the rest of the family. A charming family. Devoted to their elder sister and without an idea in their heads that she might prove to have committed a crime. Why bring sorrow on them when I could prove nothing? The lady's admission to me was unheard by anyone else. I let nature take its course. Miss Amy Barton died 6 months after my meeting with her. I've often wondered if she was cheerful and unrepentant up to the end."
"Surely not," said Mrs. Bantry.
"I expect so," said Miss Marple. "Mrs. Trout was." Jane Hellyer gave herself a little shake.
"Well," she said, "it's very, very thrilling. I don't quite understand now who drowned which. And how does this Mrs. Trout come into it?"
"She doesn't, my dear," said Miss Marple. "She was only a person, not a very nice person, in the village."
"Oh," said Jane, "in the village. But nothing ever happens in a village, does it?" She sighed. "I'm sure I shouldn't have any brains at all if I lived in a village."
A Christmas Tragedy. "I have a complaint to make," said Sir Henry Clithering. His eyes twinkled gently as he looked round at the assembled company. Colonel Bantry, his legs stretched out, was frowning at the mantelpiece as though it were a delinquent soldier on parade. His wife was surreptitiously glancing at a catalogue of bulbs which had come by the late post. Dr. Lloyd was gazing with frank admiration at Jane Hillier, and that beautiful young actress herself was thoughtfully regarding her pink polished nails. Only that elderly spinster lady, Miss Marple, was sitting bolt upright, and her faded blue eyes met Sir Henry's with an answering twinkle. "A complaint," she murmured. "A very serious complaint. We are a company of six, three representatives of each sex, and I protest on behalf of the downtrodden males. We have had three stories told tonight, and told by the three men. I protest that the ladies have not done their fair share." "Oh," said Mrs. Banty with indignation, "I'm sure we have. We listened with the most intelligent appreciation. We've displayed the true womanly attitude, not wishing to thrust ourselves into the limelight." "It's an excellent excuse," said Sir Henry, "but it won't do. And there's a very good precedent in the Arabian Nights. So, forward, Sherazade." "Meaning me," said Mrs. Bantry, "but I haven't anything to tell. I've never been surrounded by blood or mystery." "I don't absolutely insist upon blood," said Sir Henry, "but I'm sure one of you three ladies has got a pet mystery. Come now, Miss Marple, the curious coincidence of the charwoman, or the mystery of the mother's meeting. Well, don't disappoint me in St. Mary's Mead." Miss Marple shook her head. "Nothing that would interest you, Sir Henry. We have our little mysteries, of course. There was that Jill of picked shrimps that disappeared so incomprehensibly, but that wouldn't interest you, because it all turned out to be so trivial, though throwing a considerable light on human nature." "You've taught me to dote on human nature," said Sir Henry solemnly. "What about you, Miss Hellyer?" asked Colonel Bantry. "You must have had some interesting experiences." "Yes, indeed," said Dr. Lloyd. "Me," said Jane. "You mean you want me to tell you something that happened to me?" "Or to one of your friends," amended Sir Henry. "Oh," said Jane vaguely, I don't think anything's ever happened to me. Not that kind of thing. Flowers, of course, and queer messages, but that's just men, isn't it? I don't think..." She paused and appeared lost in thought. "I see we shall have to have that epic of the shrimp," said Sir Henry. "Now then, Miss Marple." "You're so fond of your jokes, Sir Henry. The shrimps are only nonsense. But now I come to think of it, I do remember one incident. At least, not exactly an incident. Something very much more serious, a tragedy. And I was, in a way, mixed up in it. And for what I did, I've never had any regrets. No, no regrets at all. But it didn't happen in St. Mary Mead."
"That disappoints me," said Sir Henry. "But I'll endeavour to bear up. I knew we should not rely upon you in vain." He settled himself in the attitude of a listener.
Miss Marple grew slightly pink. I hope I shall be able to tell it properly," she said anxiously. I'm very inclined to become rambling. One wanders from the point, altogether without knowing that one is doing so. And so hard to remember each fact in its proper order. You must all bear with me if I tell my story badly. It happened a very long time ago now. As I say, it was not connected with St. Mary Mead. As a matter of fact, it had to do with a hydro.
"Do you mean a seaplane?" asked Jane with wide eyes.
"You wouldn't know, dear," said Mrs. Bantry, and explained. Her husband added his quota. "Beastly places, absolutely beastly. Got to get up early and drink filthy-tasting water. Lot of old women sitting about, ill-natured tittle-tattle. God, when I think..." "Now, Arthur," said Mrs. Bantry placidly, "you know it did you all the good in the world." "Lot of old women sitting round talking scandal," grunted Colonel Bantry.
"That, I'm afraid, is true," said Miss Marple. "I myself..."
"My dear Miss Marple," cried the Colonel, horrified, "I didn't mean for one moment..." With pink cheeks and a little gesture of the hand, Miss Marple stopped him. "Oh, but it's true, Colonel Bantry. Oh, now, I should just like to say this. Now, let me recollect my thoughts. Yes, talking scandal, as you say, well, it is done a good deal, and people are very down on it, especially young people. My nephew, who writes books, and very clever ones, I believe, has said the most scathing things about taking people's characters away without any kind of proof, and how wicked it is and all that, but what I say is that none of these young people ever stop to think. They really don't examine the facts. Surely the whole crux of the matter is this. How often is tittle-tattle, as you call it, true? And I think if, as I say, they really examined the facts, they would find that it was true 9 times out of 10. That's really just what makes people so annoyed about it.
The inspired guess, said Sir Henry.
No, no, not that, not that at all. It's really a matter of practice and experience. An Egyptologist, so I've heard, if you show him one of those curious little beetles, can tell you by the look and the feel of the thing what date B.C. it is, or if it's a Birmingham imitation. And he can't always give a definite rule for doing so, he just knows. His life has been spent handling such things. And that's what I'm trying to say, very badly, I know. What my nephew calls superfluous women have a lot of time on their hands, and their chief interest is usually people. And so, you see, they get to be what one might call experts. Now, young people nowadays, they talk very freely about things that weren't mentioned in my young days, but on the other hand, their minds are terribly innocent. They believe in everyone and everything. And if one tries to warn them ever so gently, they tell one that one has a Victorian mind. And that, they say, is like a sink.
After all, said Sir Henry, what is wrong with a sink?
Exactly, said Miss Marple eagerly. It's the most necessary thing in any house, but of course not romantic. Now, I must confess that I have my feelings like everyone else, and I've sometimes been cruelly hurt by unthinking remarks. I know gentlemen are not interested in domestic matters, but I must mention my maid Ethel, a very good-looking girl and obliging in every way. Now, I realized as soon as I saw her that she was the same type as Annie Webb and poor Mrs. Brewitt's girl. If the opportunity arose, mine and thine would mean nothing to her. So I let her go at the month, and I gave her a written reference saying she was honest and sober. But privately, I warned old Mrs. Edwards against taking her. And my nephew Raymond was exceedingly angry and said he'd never heard of anything so wicked. Yes, wicked! Well, she went to Lady Ashton, whom I felt no obligation to warn, and what happened? All the lace cut off her underclothes, and 2 diamond brooches taken, and the girl departed in the middle of the night and was never heard of since. Miss Marple paused, drew a long breath, and then went on, "You'll be saying this has nothing to do with what went on at Keston Spa Hydro, but it has in a way. It explains why I felt no doubt in my mind the first moment I saw the Saunders together that he meant to do away with her." "Eh?" said Sir Henry, leaning forward. Miss Marple turned a placid face to him. "As I say, Sir Henry, I felt no doubt in my own mind. Mr. Saunders was a big, good-looking, florid-faced man, very hearty in his manner, and popular with all, and nobody could have been pleasanter to his wife than he was. But I knew he meant to make away with her."
"My dear Miss Marple."
"Yes, I know. That's what my nephew Raymond West would say. He'd tell me I hadn't a shadow of proof. But I remember Walter Holmes, who kept the Green Man, walking home with his wife one night she fell into the river. And he collected the insurance money. And 1 or 2 other people are walking about scot-free to this day. One indeed in our own class of life. Went to Switzerland for a summer holiday, climbing with his wife. I warned her not to go. The poor dear didn't get angry with me as she might have done. She only laughed. Seemed to her funny that a queer old thing like me should say such things about her Harry. Well, well, there was an accident, and Harry is married to another woman now. But what could I do? I knew, but there was no proof."
"Oh, Miss Marple," cried Mrs. Bantry, "you don't really mean—"
"My dear, these things are very common indeed. And gentlemen are especially attempted, being so much the stronger. So easy if a thing looks like an accident. As I say, I knew at once with the Saunders. It was on a tram. It was full inside, and I had to go on top. We all three got up to get off, and Mr. Saunders lost his balance and fell right against his wife, sending her head first down the stairs. Fortunately, the conductor was a very strong young man and caught her.
But surely that must have been an accident."
"Of course it was an accident. Nothing could have looked more accidental. But Mr. Saunders had been in the Merchant Navy, so he told me, and a man who can keep his balance on a nasty tilting boat doesn't lose it on the top of a tram, if an old woman like me doesn't. Don't tell me.
At any rate, we can take it that you've made up your mind, Miss Marple, said Sir Henry. Made it up then and there.
The old lady nodded. I was sure enough, and another incident in crossing the street not long afterwards made me surer still. Now, I ask you, what could I do, Sir Henry? Here was a nice, contented, happy little married woman shortly going to be murdered. My dear lady, you take my breath away. That's because, like most people nowadays, you won't face facts. You prefer to think such a thing couldn't be. But it was so, and I knew it. But one is so sadly handicapped. I couldn't, for instance, go to the police, and to warn the young woman would, I see, be useless. She was devoted to the man. I just made it my business to find out as much as I could about them. One has a lot of opportunities, doing one's needlework round the fire. Mrs. Saunders, Gladys her name was only too willing to talk. It seems they had not been married very long. Her husband had some property that was coming to him, but for the moment they were very badly off. In fact, they were living on her little income. One has heard that tale before. She bemoaned the fact that she could not touch the capital. It seemed that somebody had had some sense somewhere, but the money was hers to will away. I found that out. And she and her husband had made wills in favour of each other directly after their marriage. Very touching. Of course, when Jack's affairs came right, that was a burden all day long, and in the meantime they were very hard up indeed. Actually had a room on the top floor, all among the servants. And so dangerous in case of fire, though, as it happened, there was a fire escape just outside their window. I inquired carefully if there was a balcony. Dangerous things, balconies. One push, you know. I made her promise not to go out on the balcony. I said I'd had a dream. That impressed her. One can do a lot with superstition sometimes. She was a fair girl, rather washed-out complexion, and an untidy roll of hair on her neck. Very credulous. She repeated what I'd said to her husband, and I noticed him looking at me in a curious way once or twice. He wasn't credulous, and he knew that I'd been on that tramp. But I was very worried, terribly worried, because I couldn't see how to circumvent him. I could prevent anything happening at the hydro just by saying a few words to show him I suspected. But that only meant his putting off his plan till later. No, I began to believe that the only policy was a bold one. Somehow or other, to lay a trap for him. If I could induce him to attempt her life in a way of my own choosing, well, then he would be unmasked, and she'd be forced to face the truth, however much of a shock it was to her. "Take my breath away," said Dr. Lloyd. "What conceivable plan could you adopt?"
"I'd have found one. Never fear," said Miss Marple. "But the man was too clever for me. He didn't wait. He thought I might suspect, and so he struck before I could be sure. He knew I would suspect an accident. So he made it murder."
A little gasp went round the circle. Miss Marple nodded and set her lips grimly together. I'm afraid I put that rather abruptly. I must try and tell you exactly what occurred. I've always felt very bitterly about it. It seems to me that I ought somehow to have prevented it. But doubtless Providence knew best. I did what I could, at all events. There was what I can only describe as a curiously eerie feeling in the air. There seemed to be something weighing on us all, a feeling of misfortune. To begin with, there was George, the hall porter. He'd been there for years and knew everybody. Bronchitis and pneumonia, and passed away on the fourth day. Terribly sad. A real blow to everybody. And 4 days before Christmas, too. And then one of the housemaids, such a nice girl. A septic finger. Actually died in 24 hours. I was in the drawing room with Miss Trollope, and old Mrs. Carpenter, and Mrs. Carpenter was being positively ghoulish, relishing it all, you know. "Mark my word," she said, "this isn't the end. You know the saying, never two without three. I've proved it true time and again. There'll be another death, not a doubt of it, and we shan't have long to wait. Never two without three." As she said the last words, nodding her head and clicking her knitting needles, I just chanced to look up, and there was Mr. Saunders standing in the doorway. Just for a minute he was off guard, and I saw the look in his face as plain as plain. I shall believe till my dying day that it was the ghoulishness, Mrs. Carpenter's words, that put the whole thing into his head. I saw his mind working. He came forward into the room, smiling in his genial way. "Any Christmas shopping I can do for you ladies?" he asked. "I'm going down to Keston presently." He stayed a minute or two, laughing and talking, and then went out. As I tell you, I was troubled, and I said straight away, "Where's Mrs. Saunders? Does anyone know?" Mrs. Trollope said she'd gone out to some friends of hers, the Mortimers, to play bridge, and that eased my mind for the moment. But I was still very worried and most uncertain as to what to do. About half an hour later, I went up to my room. I met Dr. Coles, my doctor, there coming down the stairs as I was going up, and as I happened to want to consult him about my rheumatism, I took him into my room with me there and then. He mentioned to me then, in confidence, he said, about the death of the poor girl, Mary. The manager didn't want the news to get about, he said, so would I keep it to myself. Of course, I didn't tell him that we'd all been discussing nothing else for the last hour, ever since the poor girl breathed her last. These things are always known at once, and a man of his experience should know that well enough. But Dr. Coles was always a simple, unsuspicious fellow who believed what he wanted to believe, and that's just what alarmed me a minute later. He said as he was leaving that Saunders had asked him to have a look at his wife. It seemed she'd been seedy of late. Indigestion, etc. Now, that very same day, Gladys Saunders had said to me that she'd got a wonderful digestion and was thankful for it. You see, all my suspicions of that man came back 100-fold. He was preparing the way. For what? Dr. Coles left before I could make up my mind whether to speak to him or not, though really, if I had spoken, I shouldn't have known what to say. As I came out of my room, the man himself, Saunders, came down the stairs from the floor above. He was dressed to go out, and he asked me again if he could do anything for me in town. It was all I could do to be civil to the man. I went straight into the lounge and ordered tea. It was just on 5:30, I remember. Now, I'm very anxious to put clearly what happened next. I was still in the lounge at 7:15 when Mr. Saunders came in. There were two gentlemen with him, and all three of them were inclined to be a little on the lively side. Mr. Saunders left his two friends and came right over to where I was sitting with Miss Trollope. He explained that he wanted our advice about a Christmas present he was giving his wife. It was an evening bag. "And you see, ladies," he said, "I'm only a rough sailor man. What do I know about such things? I've had three sent to me on approval, and I want an expert opinion on them." We said, of course, that we would be delighted to help him, and he asked if we'd mind coming upstairs, as his wife might come in any minute if he brought the bags down. So we went up with him. I shall never forget what happened next. I can feel my little fingers tingling now. Mr. Saunders opened the door of the bedroom and switched on the light. I don't know which of us saw it first. Mrs. Saunders was lying on the floor, face downwards, dead. I got to her first. I knelt down and took her hand and felt for the pulse, but it was useless. The arm itself was cold and stiff. Just by her head was a stocking filled with sand, the weapon she'd been struck down with. Miss Trollope's silly creature was moaning and moaning by the door and holding her head. Saunders gave a great cry of, "My wife, my wife," and rushed to her. I stopped him touching her. You see, I was sure at the moment that he'd done it, and there might have been something that he wanted to take away or hide. "Nothing must be touched," I said. "Pull yourself together, Mr. Sanders. Miss Trollope, please go down and fetch the manager." I stayed there, kneeling by the body. I wasn't going to leave Sanders alone with it. And yet I was forced to admit that if the man was acting, he was acting marvellously. He looked dazed and bewildered and scared out of his wits. The manager was with us in no time. He made a quick inspection of the room, then turned us all out and locked the door, the key of which he took. Then he went off and telephoned to the police. Seemed a positive age before they came. We learnt afterwards that the line was out of order. The manager had to send a messenger to the police station, and the hydro is right out of the town upon the edge of the moor, and Mrs. Carpenter tried us all very severely. She was so pleased at her prophecy of never two without three coming true so quickly. Sanders, I hear, wandered out into the grounds, clutching his head and groaning and displaying every sign of grief. However, the police came at last. They went upstairs with the manager and Mr. Sanders. Later, they sent down for me. I went up. The inspector was there, sitting at a table, writing. He was an intelligent-looking man, and I liked him. "Miss Jane Marple," he said. "Yes. I understand, madam, that you were present when the body of the deceased was found." I said I was, and I described exactly what had occurred. I think it was a relief to the poor man to find someone who could answer his questions coherently, having previously had to deal with Sanders and Emily Trollope, who I gather was completely demoralized. She would be the silly creature. I remember my dear mother teaching me that a gentlewoman should always be able to control herself in public, however much she may give way in private. "An admirable maxim," said Sir Henry gravely. When I had finished, the inspector said, "Thank you, madam. Now I am afraid I must ask you just to look at the body once more. Is that exactly the position in which it was lying when you entered the room? It hasn't been moved in any way?" I explained that I had prevented Mr. Sanders from doing so, and the inspector nodded approval. "The gentleman seems terribly upset," he remarked. "He seems so." "Yes," I replied. I don't think I put any special emphasis on the seams, but the inspector looked at me rather keenly. "So we can take it that the body is exactly as it was when found," he said. "Except for the hat." "Yes," I replied. The inspector looked up sharply. "What do you mean, the hat?" I explained that the hat had been on poor Gladys's head, whereas now it was lying beside her. I thought, of course, that the police had done this. The inspector, however, denied it emphatically. Nothing had as yet been moved or touched. He looked down at that poor, prone figure with a puzzled frown. Gladys was dressed in her outdoor clothes, a big dark red tweed coat with a grey fur collar. The hat, a cheap affair of red felt, lay just by her head. The inspector stood for some minutes in silence, frowning to himself. Then an idea struck him. "Can you by any chance remember, madam, whether there were earrings in the ears, or whether the deceased habitually wore earrings?" Now, fortunately, I am in the habit of observing closely. I remember that there had been a glint of pearls just below the hat brim, though I had paid no particular notice to it at the time. I was able to answer his first question in the affirmative. "Then that settles it. The lady's jewel case was rifled, not that she had anything much of value, I understand, and the rings were taken from her fingers. The murderer must have forgotten the earrings and come back for them after the murder was discovered. A cool customer. Or perhaps..." He stared round the room and said slowly, "He may have been concealed here in this room all the time." But I negatived that idea. I myself, I explained, had looked under the bed, and the manager had opened the door to the wardrobe. There was nowhere else where a man could hide. It's true the hat cupboard was locked in the middle of the wardrobe, but as that was only a shallow affair with shelves, no one could have been concealed there. The inspector nodded his head slowly while I explained all this. "I'll take your word for it, madam," he said. "In that case, as I said before, he must have come back. A very cool customer." But the manager locked the door and took the key. "That's nothing," The balcony and the fire escape? That's the way the thief came. Why, as likely as not, you continually disturbed him at work. He slips out of the window, and when you've all gone, back he comes and goes on with his business.
You are sure, I said, that there was a thief?
He said dryly.
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it?
But something in his tone satisfied me. I felt he wouldn't take Mr. Saunders in the role of the bereaved widower too seriously. You see, I admitted frankly I was absolutely under the opinion of what I believe our neighbours, the French, call the idée fixe. I knew that that man, Saunders, intended his wife to die. What I didn't allow for was that strange and fantastic thing, coincidence. My views about Mr. Saunders were, I was sure of it, absolutely right and true. The man was a scoundrel. But although his hypocritical assumptions of grief didn't deceive me for a minute, I do remember feeling at the time that his surprise and bewilderment were marvellously well done. They seemed absolutely natural, if you know what I mean. I must admit that after my conversation with the inspector, a curious feeling of doubt crept over me, because if Saunders had done this dreadful thing, I couldn't imagine any conceivable reason why he should creep back by means of the fire escape and take the earrings from his wife's ears. It wouldn't have been a sensible thing to do, and Saunders was very much a sensible man. That's just why I always felt he was so dangerous. Miss Marple looked round at her audience. You see, perhaps, what I'm coming to? It is so often the unexpected that happens in this world. I was so sure, and that, I think, was what blinded me. The result came as a shock to me, for it was proved, beyond any possible doubt, that Mr. Saunders could not possibly have committed the crime. A surprised gasp came from Mrs. Bantry. Miss Marple turned to her. "I know, my dear, that isn't what you expected when I began this story. It wasn't what I expected, but facts are facts, and if one is proved to be wrong, one must just be humble about it and start again. That Mr. Saunders was a murderer at heart, I knew, and nothing ever occurred to upset that firm conviction of mine. And now I expect you'd like to hear the actual facts themselves. Mrs. Saunders, as you know, spent the afternoon playing bridge with some friends, the Mortimers. She left them at about 6:15. From her friend's house to the hydro was about 1/4 hour's walk, less if one hurried. She must have come in then about 6:30. No one saw her come in, so she must have entered by the side door and hurried straight up to her room. There she changed. The fawn coat and skirt she wore to the bridge party were hanging up in the cupboard, and was evidently preparing to go out again when the blow fell. Quite possibly, they say, she never even knew who struck her. The sandbag, I understand, is a very efficient weapon. That looks as though the attackers were concealed in the room, possibly in one of the big wardrobe cupboards, the one that she didn't open. Now, as to the movement of Mr. Saunders, he went out, as I have said, at about 5:30 or a little after. He did some shopping at a couple of shops, and at about 6:00 he entered the Grand Spa Hotel, where he encountered two friends, the same with whom he returned to the hydro later. They played billiards, and I gather had a good many whiskies and sodas together. These two men, Hitchcock and Spender, their names were actually with him the whole time from 6:00 onwards. They walked back to the hydro with him, and he only left them to come across to me and Miss Trollope. That, as I told you, was about 7:15, at which time his wife must have been already dead. I must tell you that I talked myself to these two friends of his. I did not like them. They were neither pleasant nor gentlemanly men, but I was quite certain of one thing, that they were speaking the absolute truth when they said that Saunders had been the whole time in their company. There was just one other little point that came up. It seems that while bridge was going on, Mrs. Saunders was called to the telephone. A Mr. Littleworth wanted to speak to her. She seemed both excited and pleased about something, and incidentally made one or two bad mistakes. She left rather earlier than they had expected her to do. Mr. Sanders was asked whether he knew the name of Littleworth as being one of his wife's friends, but he declared he'd never heard of anyone of that name. And to me that seems borne out by his wife's attitude. She, too, did not seem to know the name of Littleworth. Nevertheless, she came back from the telephone, smiling and blushing, so it looks as though whoever it was did not give it his real name. And that in itself has a suspicious aspect, does it not? Anyway, that is the problem that was left. The burglar story, which seems unlikely, or the alternative theory that Mrs. Sanders was preparing to go out and meet somebody. Did that somebody come to her room by means of the fire escape? Was there a quarrel? Or did he treacherously attack her? Miss Marple stopped. "Well," said Sir Henry, "what is the answer?" "I wonder if any of you could guess." "I'm never good at guessing," said Mrs. Bantry. "It seems a pity that Sanders had such a wonderful alibi, but if it satisfied you, it must have been all right." Jane Hellyer moved her beautiful head and asked a question. "Why," she said, "was the hat cupboard locked?" "How very clever of you, my dear," said Miss Marple, beaming. "That's just what I wondered myself, though the explanation was quite simple. In it were a pair of embroidered slippers and some pocket handkerchiefs that the poor girl was embroidering for her husband for Christmas. That's why she locked the cupboard. The key was found in her handbag." "Oh," said Jane, "then it isn't very interesting after all." "Oh, but it is," said Miss Marple. "Just the one really interesting thing. The thing that made all the murderer's plans go wrong." Everyone stared at the old lady. "I didn't see it myself for 2 days," said Miss Marple. "I puzzled and puzzled, and then suddenly there it was, all clear. I went to the inspector and asked him to try something, and he did."
"What did you ask him to try?"
"I asked him to fit that hat on the poor girl's head. And of course he couldn't. It wouldn't go on. It wasn't her hat, you see." Mrs. Bantry stared. "But it was on her head to begin with." "Not on her head." Miss Marple stopped a moment to let the words sink in, and then went on. "We took it for granted that it was poor Gladys's body there, but we never looked at the face. She was face downward, remember, and the hat hid everything."
"But she was killed."
"Yes, later. At the moment that we were telephoning to the police, Gladys Sanders was alive and well."
"You mean it was someone pretending to be her? But surely when you touched her..."
"It was a dead body, right enough," said Miss Marple gravely.
"But dash it all," said Colonel Bantry, "you can't get hold of dead bodies right and left. What did they do with the first corpse afterwards?"
"He put it back," said Miss Marple. "It was a wicked idea, but a very clever one. It was our talk in the drawing-room that put it into his head. The body of poor Mary, the housemaid. Why not use it? Remember, the Sanders room was up among the servants' quarters. Mary's door was 2 doors off. The undertakers wouldn't come till after dark. He counted on that. He carried the body along to the balcony. It was dark at 5, dressed it in one of his wife's dresses and her big red coat, and then he found the hat cupboard locked. There was only one thing to be done. He fetched one of the poor girl's own hats. No one would notice. He put the sandbag down beside her. Then he went off to establish his alibi. He telephoned to his wife, calling himself Mr. Littleworth. I don't know what he said to her. She was a credulous girl, as I said just now. But he got her to leave the bridge party early and not to go back to the hydro, and arranged with her to meet him in the grounds of the hydro near the fire escape at 7 o'clock. He probably told her he had some surprise for her. He returns to the hydro with his friends and arranges that Miss Trollope and I shall discover the crime with him. He even pretends to turn the body over, and I stop him. Then the police are sent for, and he staggers out into the grounds. Nobody asked him for an alibi after the crime. He meets his wife, takes her up to the fire escape. They enter their room. Perhaps he has already told her some story about the body. She stoops over it, and he picks up his sandbag and strikes. Oh, dear. Makes me sick to think of, even now. Then quickly he strips off her coat and skirt, hangs them up, and dresses her in the clothes from the other body. But the hat won't go on. Mary's head is shingled. Gladys Sanders, as I say, had a great bun of hair. He's forced to leave it beside the body and hope no one will notice. Then he carries poor Mary's body back to her own room and arranges it decorously once more.
"Seems incredible," said Dr. Lloyd. "The risks he took. The police might have arrived too soon."
"You remember the line was out of order," said Miss Marple. "That was a piece of his work. He couldn't afford to have the police on the spot too soon. When they did come, they spent some time in the manager's office before going up to the bedroom. That was the weakest point. The chance that someone might notice the difference between a body that had been dead 2 hours and one that had been dead just over half an hour. But he counted on the fact that the people who first discovered the crime would have no expert knowledge." Dr. Lloyd nodded. "The crime would be supposed to have been committed about 6:45 or thereabouts, I suppose," he said. "It was actually committed at 7 or a few minutes after. When the police surgeon examined the body, it would be about 7:30 at earliest. He couldn't possibly tell." "I am the person who should have known," said Miss Marple. "I felt the poor girl's hand, and it was icy cold. Yet a short time later the inspector spoke as though the murder must have been committed just before we arrived. And I saw nothing."
"I think you saw a good deal, Miss Marple," said Sir Henry. "The case was before my time. I don't even remember hearing of it. What happened?"
"Sanders was hanged," said Miss Marple crisply, "and a good job, too. Never regretted my part in bringing that man to justice. I've no patience with modern humanitarian scruples about capital punishments." Her stern face softened. "But I've often reproached myself bitterly with failing to save the life of that poor girl. But who would have listened to an old woman jumping to conclusions? Well, well, who knows? Perhaps it was better for her to die while life was still happy than it would have been for her to live on, unhappy and disillusioned, in a world that would have seemed suddenly horrible. She loved that scoundrel and trusted him. She never found him out."
"Well, then," said Jane Hillier, "she was all right, quite all right. I wish—"
Miss Marple looked at the famous, the beautiful, the successful Jane Hillier, and nodded her head gently. "I see, my dear," she said very gently. "I see."
End of Disc 4.